repetition of 12385, rule one.
Mr. Williamson, reel one. Mr. Williamson, can you tell me where you were born and your date of birth, please?
Oh, yes. I was born in Winnipeg, Manitoba, 1907, September 17th. And I lived there for the all my early days there. My mother divorced when I was very young, and I was brought up by an aunt in Winnipeg, and I lived the ordinary life of a very young boy. But my aunt had a friend. I don't know what the relationship was, but I always called him Old Paddy. It was Paddy Murphy, and he was, so I don't know whether he ever fought in the Troubles in Ireland, but I had a feeling that he took part in strikes in Dublin in Ireland and so on, and then later went to Canada. So I don't think he could have taken part in the uprising in the Easter uprising in Ireland, but I'm not certain about that. But anyway, he had a sort of hatred or dislike of imperialism in general, and in particular that for the British Empire, which he thought was enslaving the world. Roughly at that time, the same position as the United States is in today. He was imbibed with this hatred of British imperialism and the British Empire and so on. And I remember when I was a very young boy, him pointing to, on some holiday or anything, pointing to the Union Jack flying above some building or other, and he says, look at that flag, boy. Wherever that flag flies, there's misery and oppression. And that had a great effect on me. Also, Paddy.
How old were you then, Bill, when that happened? Can you remember?
Oh, I must have been very, very young. I suppose just when I could barely remember it. About six, I suppose. But what I do remember is when I was getting on for, it must have been when I was just seven of him coming along and saying to me, of course, I was given a great deal of freedom. I don't know whether my aunt believed in all this that he said, but she didn't object to him telling me about this, because he had a great, he was a great reader. He had a great stock of all these great books that, especially the books of Tom Paine. But I do remember that, just vaguely remember it, that he was coming one winter's day and saying something wonderful has happened. The workers have taken power in Russia. I hardly knew. Well, I knew roughly, I presume. Of course, I read, and I was interested in geography in that time. I suppose I knew what Russia was, but anyway, the chief thing is that they've gotten rid of the king, and a revolution has broken out there. I don't know whether that was the first revolution, or whether that was the November Revolution. I think It could have, that is very hazy in my mind. He could have mentioned both of them, but I think chiefly he was talking about the November Revolution led by Lenin. And I sort of vaguely, because he'd already imbued me with the idea that we shouldn't have a king of Canada, that that was for a foreign power, you know, that's Britain. And we shouldn't have the Union Jack flying everywhere, and especially with a Canadian flag. One quarter of it was taken up with the Union Jack in the corner. I always had, even from the earliest times, this dislike about that. And then from that time onwards, whether it was before that he started giving me books, but the great books by Jack London, he started me off on his great books of the North, White Fang, The Call of the Wild, and the separate ones. And then long before I was 10 years of age, maybe as early as 8, he was giving me the deeper books of Jack London's Children of the Abyss and John Barleycorn, and I read most all of Jack London's books at that time. He had a wonderful library, this Irishman. He also told me about Tom Connolly, and how he struggled against the British in the Easter Uprising, whether that was through, whether he actually knew that or not, or whether he just knew of it, or whether he'd taken part, I'm not quite clear on that. But the thing that impressed me is how these terrible imperialists, that when... did I say Tom Connolly? James Connolly, I meant to say, but James Connolly, when they were defeated with the cannon and so on that the British brought up against them, and then he was very, very badly wounded. They condemned him to death, tied him to a chair, and as he couldn't stand, they just shot him. Much of the same as the Nazis shot their prisoners some 50 years later on.
Sorry, before you tell me a bit about that,
yes.
Could you tell me what your schooling was like at this time, your conventional schooling?
Oh, yes. The schooling was very, very... it was very, very intermittent. In the summer, I often played hooky from school because I liked swimming in the rivers, the Assiniboine and the Red River in Winnipeg. My school teachers, succession of, I sort of drove them sort of crazy because I was asking all these questions when they were talking about religion, whether it came, I can't recollect whether it was, whether they had regular religious classes or not. But when it came up, I was asking all sorts of awkward questions because this old Irishman had imbibed me with the idea that there was no God. I was asking that. And when they sometimes mentioned about God ascending into heaven, I remember saying, well, if he's descending into heaven here at the other end of the world, he must be going in the other direction, that and angels sort of thing, that I just couldn't believe that the wings did no way look big enough to hold people up. I was sort of...
Cool. Can we stop here a second?
Yes.
I think we're just having a bit of a problem.
It was actually all right. No, it was okay.
Yes.
You were just talking about your schooling, and you were telling me
about
how you didn't get on with your teachers.
Well, I got on with the teachers all right, but I must have driven them way up the wall there because, I was always questioning them. When they brought about English history into the thing, I was questioning that about the right of kings to rule and to send the ignorant serfs off to do battle and this sort of thing, and also that one of the greatest great point about it, you even questioned when they were fighting, the British were fighting the Americans. I took the side of the Americans of that Montcalm is against against Wolfe in Quebec, and I think, of course, I was very confused, and it was just with this teaching of Paddy's that I just felt that there were here these revolutionary Americans, and they were, and the Canadians were just playing the British game. They were fighting for the British crown and so on. I see now how wrong that I was, because it would be a bad thing that if you didn't have an independent Canada. But that, at that time, and I still think that if we'd had more in the history of Canada, that more people of in the early days, like the great American people, I'm not talking so much about Washington, but I'm talking about the other great leaders in America. And particularly, I was thinking, can you cut it off just for a minute?
Well,
yes. Want me to go on?
Just say what you're saying, but repeat that about...
Pardon?
Repeat that, Bill, what you're saying. Mr.
Oh,
Wilson.
Yes. I felt that the great leaders of the American Revolution, they were the people to be copied and followed, especially Jefferson, more so than Washington. It's interesting to... that it was an Englishman come American, Thomas Paine, that laid the whole basis for the American Revolution with his Rights of Man. There where he was talking about Washington was starting out by saying, we want to be represented with our, we don't want to be unjustly taxed without representation. Whereas it was Tom Paine who first sowed the seeds in Congress there of saying, it's no good just tinkering with these things. We will want a complete revolution, a complete break with Britain. And it was only after a long struggle that Washington came to agree with that. But all these things... I used to know them way more clearly, but times have dimmed my memory, I'm afraid.
Mr. Williamson, what sort of school did you go to?
Oh, first of all, we went to the ordinary public school in Canada. The first of all, the infant school, and then the just the ordinary school. But when I was about... 7 or 8, my aunt married, and we went to live on the person she went to live on his farm, and that I thought was a wonderful thing. It was only a small farm, but they did have a couple of cows, and I had a pony to ride, and that gave me a great deal of satisfaction. We went to the little schoolhouse a long way away. I had to ride to the schoolhouse there in the summer, and in the winter you went on a sled, that I enjoyed very much. But I think 3 or 4 years later, I don't know for what reason, the farm was sold. We went back to live in Winnipeg. At that time, when I came increasingly in conflict with my this fellow, Kennedy, that my aunt had married, that I feel the fault was probably entirely mine, that I was rebellious and always wanting to do what I wanted to do, and never paid any heed to except for my aunt. She could control me fairly well. But anyway, some sort of row developed. I can't remember what it was. And when I was around 12, I guess, nearly 13, I just felt, anyway, by this time I'd read all these books of Jack London. And another book of Jack London's that made a great impression on me was...
Sorry, what happened when you were 12 or 13 after this argument?
Oh, yes, that's what I was coming to when I was 12 or 13 after this. But previous to this, one of Jack London's books that had impressed me so much was his exploits as a hobo, about hoboing all over the United States and so on. I thought, well, at least that's something that I could do, that... I suppose I was way younger than Jack London when he started off on his hobo travels. But before this, when we'd at all times, I had a great love for the steam locomotives. And whenever I could escape from school or after school, I'd be down at the freight yards or the railroad depot watching the trains. The overland expresses or the freight trains being made up in the yards. And I'd also watch groups of hobos hiding behind other trucks. I'd seen that over 2 or 3 years, and then jumping onto the boxcars and I thought, well, that's something that I'd like to do. And so that early one morning, I just skipped home, got a few things together and put it in a sort of knapsack and went down to the freight yards. That I suppose it must have been fairly early in the morning. I saw them making up a freight for going west. This was sometime, I guess, must have been late spring or early summer. And I saw this train. I just knew enough about it. I was very agile at that time that I could move and jump on. And I was very, very large for my age too. That and so that whenever I went anywhere, I always put on about 2 or 3 years on my age. Of course, it was fatal to say you were a young boy at that time. You at least got to be a teenager, and well, an older teenager. And I suppose I can't recollect actually how far we went on the freight. I think it was fairly uneventful. The shacks on the train, the train crew, they didn't seem to be in evidence very much. And you dropped off at other towns. There was a great deal of sort of friendliness and so on amongst the hobos. They were people just people going from one place to another looking for work, and they weren't layabouts or as far as I could see they weren't. And then you got as far west as Saskatchewan somewhere, and I got a job hay making and in the harvesting and so on, and you could get the job. Of course, you looked young and so on. Although I said I was 3 years older than I was. I was about 16 and so on, but they thought you were young and could exploit you, you see.
So you were 16 when you were...
I was 13 then, so that... So just about 13, not quite 13 actually, 12, but I said I was 16 that... and there were other boys, none of them as young as myself, but there were one or two other boys, 16, 17 and so on. And you got into fights now and again, but I always tried to steer clear of that. We were dreadfully exploited working for... very, very small pittances, and the living conditions were where you're working in sort of bunkhouse were just sort of and the food, what, as I recollect,
Mr. Williamson, can you describe? Pardon? Can you describe the bunkhouse where you stayed when you were harvesting?
Yes, it's just a shack, not much better than a barn, really, and with a couple of tiers of bunks, one above the others. It was only mostly used at harvesting times.
How many men stayed in there?
Well, in various places. You might be on a small farm, and you might find just half a dozen there. And another place you might find perhaps a couple of dozen. And at that time, that it was sort of another thing. I think Paddy had told me about a wonderful organization that has grown up, but it was sort of gradually dying out, the Wobblies. The industrial workers of the world, I don't know whether you've heard of those, so when I came in contact with someone, another hobo who was an organizer for them, I signed up and got the, they gave you a little red songbook, if I remember, with all the sort of revolutionary songs and so on there, the workers' songs, and they were very colourful stories about prison life and stories about hobo life. And 11 more months and 10 more days I'll be out of this calaboose, in 11 more 10 days and 10 more days, 11 more months and 10 more days, they're going to turn me loose. That's all I remember from the hobo song, or the, from the prison song. And then there was the hobo song, I'd beat my way from Frisco Bay to the rockbound coast of Maine, from Canada to Mexico, and winded back again. all these, and you get used to have sing songs with me, and of course the printed in Place of Pride was the International, that, so that anyway, I
can I just interrupt, Mr.
Sure, Williams? Yes.
Did this man or the Wobblies you were with try to organise any disputes with the workers or defend your, improve your conditions of work?
Oh, yes, that, I should have mentioned that, he said, you know, wherever you go where you're being exploited, and we were all exploited.
How were you exploited?
Well, we're working for a mere pittance that I can't recollect what it was, how much it was for, but you were living, and so much was taken out for your keep that at the end of the week or there was very, very little left. I think I went on. I don't know how old this guy. He was a young guy, I suppose, but he was... and then I think he got into, he started by going up and demanding more wages or better conditions and things like that.
Where was this?
Pardon?
Where was this?
This was in Saskatchewan. And then, and of course, once you started to do that, you were out. So that, so you were back on the, hoboing again to the next place.
Can you describe this event? Do you remember him going up and asking for more wages?
Pardon?
Could you describe this event for me, where this man asked for more wages or better conditions? Can you remember it?
Well, I wouldn't know. It was somewhere in Saskatchewan.
You weren't there yourself.
Pardon?
Were you there yourself?
Oh yes. You'd be. We were, I suppose, about a dozen there. That it was during the harvesting time. That was at the time when they had they were bringing in the combine harvesters. But also they we had as well as the combine. They weren't in general use. A lot of the wheat was just cut, and you had to go along, and it was just cut and bundled, and you had to stook it into stooks, which was quite some job. You were doing that from sun up to sundown, practically. And then when a cart would come along, there weren't so many... automobiles then, they were nearly all horse drawn, and then they, I know some again, it's very hazy, but you'd make haystacks of these, and you had the job of forking these stooks and throwing it up with a pitchfork, and someone else on top would be stacking it and making the haystack, and then making a sort of roof so that it's the rain doesn't get in if it comes. And in general, it's just the general farm work, heavy work, but as far as I remember, I think the food was quite good, very plain cooked food, but it was... you got enough of it. The places where you didn't get enough of it, then people sheared off. So I think the farmers mostly gave that. And I think I'm being perhaps a little unjust to the farmers too, that they were struggling for a hard time, because it's a question of what Marx said about... labor surplus value and so on, that the farmer wants to get as much out of the person working for him as possible, and the worker wants to get likewise as much as possible. But I was always conscious, but of course that was pointed out by Paddy before I left, that on this question of surplus labour, that labour is a commodity just like gold and silver or anything else. You work for someone, and the only reason someone employs you is because he will employ you depending on what sort of work you're doing or what you are or what he can afford, wants to pay you. But another thing is that this surplus value, if he's going to pay you for the full value of the work you're doing, then he's going to make no profit out of you. So he has to make, depending on what it is, whether 50% or 25% of your labour goes into the pockets of the boss. And I always remember that is brought out very, very well in one of... am I digressing? Do you mind?
Yes, I think so. Mr. Williamson, could you describe... You were saying before that this man in the Wobblies who you worked with...
Yes.
...had... been involved in a dispute for better conditions on one of these farms in Saskatchewan. Could you describe that for me? How that happened? How that came about?
Yes. Well, generally, you'd be sitting after you'd had your evening meal, your supper there. You'd be sitting around, and this fellow would speak to the guys and said, well,